Chapter 31. Christmas Eve in Cloisterham. A few strange faces in the streets. A few other faces, half strange and half familiar, once the faces of Cloisterham children, now the faces of men and women who come back from the outer world at long intervals to find the city wonderfully shrunken in size, as if it had not washed by any means well in the meanwhile. To these, the striking of the cathedral clock, and the cawing of the rooks from the cathedral tower, are like voices of their nursery time. To such as these, it has happened in their dying hours afar off, that they have imagined their chamber floor, to be strewn with the autumnal leaves fallen from the elm trees in the close. So have the rustling sounds and fresh scents of their earliest impressions revived, when the circle of their lives was very nearly traced, and the beginning and the end were drawing close together. Seasonable tokens are about. Red berries shine here and there in the lattices of Minor Canon Corner. Mr. and Mrs. Tope are daintily sticking sprigs of holly into the carvings and sconces of the cathedral stalls, as if they were sticking them into the coat buttonholes of the dean and chapter. Lavish profusion is in the shops, particularly in the articles of currants, raisins, spices, candied peel, and moist sugar. An unusual air of gallantry and dissipation is abroad, evinced in an immense bunch of mistletoe hanging in the greengrocer's shop doorway, and a poor little 12th cake, culminating in the figure of a harlequin, such a very poor little 12th cake, that one would rather call it a 24th cake or a 48th cake, to be raffled for at the pastry cook's, terms 1 shilling per member. Public amusements are not wanting. The waxwork which made so deep an impression on the reflective mind of the Emperor of China is to be seen by particular desire during Christmas week only, on the premises of the bankrupt livery stable keeper up the lane, and a new grand comic Christmas pantomime is to be produced at the theater, the latter heralded by the portrait of Signor Jacksonini the clown, saying "How do you do tomorrow?" ... quite as large as life, and almost as miserably. In short, Cloisterham is up and doing. Though from this description the high school and Miss Twinkleton's are to be excluded. From the former establishment the scholars have gone home, every one of them in love with one of Miss Twinkleton's young ladies who knows nothing about it, and only the handmaidens flutter occasionally in the windows of the latter. It is noticed, by the by, that these damsels become, within the limits of decorum, more skittish when thus interested with the concrete representation of their sex, than when dividing the representation with Miss Twinkleton's young ladies. Three are to meet at the gatehouse tonight. How does each one of the three get through the day? Neville Landless, though absolved from his books for the time by Mr. Crisparkle, whose fresh nature is by no means insensible to the charms of a holiday, reads and writes in his quiet room, with a concentrated air, until it is 2 hours past noon. He then sets himself to clearing his table, to arranging his books, and to tearing up and burning his stray papers. He makes a clean sweep of all untidy accumulations, puts all his drawers in order, and leaves no note or scrap of paper undestroyed, save such memoranda as bear directly on his studies. This done, he turns to his wardrobe, selects a few articles of ordinary wear among them, change of stout shoes and socks for walking, and packs these in a knapsack. This knapsack is new, and he bought it in the High Street yesterday. He also purchased, at the same time, and at the same place, a heavy walking stick, strong in the handle for the grip of the hand, and iron-shod. He tries this, swings it, poises it, and lays it by, with the knapsack, on a window seat. By this time his arrangements are complete. He dresses for going out, and is in the act of going indeed has left his room, and has met the Minor Canon on the staircase, coming out of his bedroom upon the same story, when he turns back again for his walking stick, thinking he will carry it now. Mr. Crisparkle, who has paused on the staircase, sees it in his hand on his immediately reappearing, takes it from him, and asks him with a smile, how he chooses a stick. Really, I don't know that I understand the subject, apostrophe, he answers. I chose it for its weight. Apostrophe, much too heavy, Neville, much too heavy. Apostrophe, to rest upon in a long walk, sir. Apostrophe, apostrophe, rest upon. Apostrophe, apostrophe, repeats Mr. Crisparkle, throwing himself into pedestrian form. You don't rest upon it, you merely balance with it. Apostrophe, I shall know better, with practice, sir. I have not lived in the walking country, you know. Apostrophe, true, apostrophe, says Mr. Crisparkle. Get into a little training, and we will have a few score miles together. I should leave you nowhere now. Do you come back before dinner? Apostrophe, I think not, as we dine early. Apostrophe, Mr. Crisparkle gives him a bright nod and a cheerful goodbye, expressing, not without intention, absolute confidence and ease. Neville repairs to the nun's house, and requests that Miss Landless may be informed that her brother is there, by appointment. He waits at the gate, not even crossing the threshold, for he is on his parole, not to put himself in Rosa's way. His sister is at least as mindful of the obligation they have taken on themselves as he can be, and loses not a moment in joining him. They meet affectionately, avoid lingering there, and walk towards the upper inland country. I am not going to tread upon forbidden ground, Helena, apostrophe, says Neville, when they have walked some distance and are turning. You will understand in another moment that I cannot help referring to, what shall I say, my infatuation. Apostrophe, had you not better avoid it, Neville? You know that I can hear nothing. Apostrophe, you can hear, my dear, what Mr. Crisparkle has heard, and heard with approval. Apostrophe, yes, I can hear so much. Apostrophe, well, it is this. I am not only unsettled and unhappy myself, but I am conscious of unsettling and interfering with other people. How do I know that, but for my unfortunate presence, you, and the rest of that former party, are engaging guardian excepted, might be dining cheerfully in Minor Canon Corner tomorrow. Indeed, it probably would be so. I can see too well that I am not high in the old lady's opinion, and it is easy to understand what an irksome clog I must be upon the hospitalities of her orderly house, especially at this time of year, when I must be kept asunder from this person, and there is such a reason for my not being brought into contact with that person, and an unfavorable reputation has preceded me with such another person, and so on. I have put this very gently to Mr. Crisparkle, for you know his self-denying ways, but still I have put it. What I have laid much greater stress upon at the same time is, that I am engaged in a miserable struggle with myself, and that a little change and absence may enable me to come through it the better. So, the weather being bright and hard, I am going on a walking expedition, and in taking myself out of everybody's way, my own included, I hope, tomorrow morning. Apostrophe, when to come back? Apostrophe, apostrophe, in a fortnight. Apostrophe, and going quite alone? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I am much better without company, even if there were anyone but you to bear me company, my dear Helena. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mr. Crisparkle entirely agrees, you say? Apostrophe, apostrophe, entirely. I am not sure, but that at first he was inclined to think it rather a moody scheme, and one that might do a brooding mind harm. But we took a moonlight walk last Monday night, to talk it over at leisure, and I represented the case to him as it really is. I showed him that I do want to conquer myself, and that, this evening well got over, it is surely better that I should be away from here just now than here. I could hardly help meeting certain people walking together here, and that could do no good, and is certainly not the way to forget. A fortnight hence, that chance will probably be over, for the time, and when it again arises for the last time, why, I can again go away. Farther, I really do feel hopeful of bracing exercise and wholesome fatigue. You know that Mr. Crisparkle allows such things their full weight in the preservation of his own sound mind in his own sound body, and that his just spirit is not likely to maintain one set of natural laws for himself and another for me. He yielded to my view of the matter, when convinced that I was honestly in earnest, and so, with his full consent, I start tomorrow morning, early enough to be not only out of the streets, but out of hearing of the bells, when the good people go to church. Apostrophe, Helena thinks it over, and thinks well of it. Mr. Crisparkle doing so, she would do so, but she does originally, out of her own mind, think well of it, as a healthy project, denoting a sincere endeavor and an active attempt at self-correction. She is inclined to pity him, poor fellow, for going away solitary on the great Christmas festival, but she feels it much more to the purpose to encourage him. And she does encourage him. He will write to her? He will write to her every alternate day, and tell her all his adventures. Does he send clothes on in advance of him? My dear Helena, no. Travel like a pilgrim, with wallet and staff. My wallet or my knapsack is packed, and ready for strapping on, and here is my staff. ... He hands it to her. She makes the same remark as Mr. Crisparkle, that it is very heavy, and gives it back to him, asking what wood it is? Iron wood. Up to this point he has been extremely cheerful. Perhaps, the having to carry his case with her, and therefore to present it in its brightest aspect, has roused his spirits. Perhaps, the having done so with success, is followed by a revulsion. As the day closes in, and the city lights begin to spring up before them, he grows depressed. I wish I were not going to this dinner, Helena. ... Dear Neville, is it worth, while to care much about it? Think how soon it will be over. ... How soon it will be over. ... He repeats gloomily. Yes. But I don't like it. ... There may be a moment's awkwardness, she cheeringly represents to him, but it can only last a moment. He is quite sure of himself. I wish I felt as sure of everything else, as I feel of myself. ... He answers her. How strangely you speak, dear. What do you mean? ... Helena, I don't know. I only know that I don't like it. What a strange dead weight there is in the air. ... She calls his attention to those copperous clouds beyond the river, and says that the wind is rising. He scarcely speaks again, until he takes leave of her, at the gate of the nun's house. She does not immediately enter, when they have parted, but remains looking after him along the street. Twice he passes the gatehouse, reluctant to enter. At length, the cathedral clock chiming one quarter, with a rapid turn he hurries in. And so he goes up the postern stair. Edwin Drood passes a solitary day. Something of deeper moment than he had thought, has gone out of his life, and in the silence of his own chamber he wept for it last night. Though the image of Miss Landless still hovers in the background of his mind, the pretty little affectionate creature, so much firmer and wiser than he had supposed, occupies its stronghold. It is with some misgiving of his own unworthiness that he thinks of her, and of what they might have been to one another, if he had been more in earnest some time ago, if he had set a higher value on her, if, instead of accepting his lot in life as an inheritance of course, he had studied the right way to its appreciation and enhancement. And still, for all this, and though there is a sharp heartache in all this, the vanity and caprice of youth sustain that handsome figure of Miss Landless in the background of his mind. That was a curious look of Rosa's, when they parted at the gate. Did it mean, that she saw below the surface of his thoughts, and down into their twilight depths? Scarcely that, for it was a look of astonished and keen inquiry. He decides that he cannot understand it, though it was remarkably expressive. As he only waits for Mr. Grewgious now, and will depart immediately after having seen him, he takes a sauntering leave of the ancient city and its neighborhood. He recalls the time, when Rosa and he walked here or there, mere children, full of the dignity of being engaged, Poor children, he thinks, with a pitying sadness. Finding that his watch has stopped, he turns into the jeweler's shop to have it wound and set. The jeweler is knowing on the subject of a bracelet, which he begs leave to submit in a general and quite aimless way. It would suit, he considers, a young bride to perfection, especially if of a rather diminutive style of beauty. Finding the bracelet, but coldly looked at, the jeweler invites attention to a tray of rings for gentlemen. Here is a style of ring, now, he remarks, a very chaste signet which gentlemen are much given to purchasing, when changing their condition. A ring of a very responsible appearance, with the date of their wedding day engraved inside. Several gentlemen have preferred it to any other kind of memento. The rings are as coldly viewed as the bracelet. Edwin tells the tempter that he wears no jewelry, but his watch and chain, which were his father's, and his shirt pin. That I was aware of, apostrophe is the jeweler's reply, for Mr. Jasper dropped in for a watch glass the other day, and, in fact, I showed these articles to him, remarking that if he should wish to make a present to a gentleman relative, on any particular occasion, but he said with a smile, that he had an inventory in his mind of all the jewelry his gentleman relative ever wore, namely, his watch and chain, and his shirt pin. Apostrophe still, the jeweler considers, that might not apply to all times, though applying to the present time. 2:20, Mr. Drood, I set your watch at. Let me recommend you, not to let it run down, sir. Apostrophe, Edwin takes his watch, puts it on, and goes out, thinking. Dear old Jack, if I were to make an extra crease in my neckcloth, he would think it worth noticing. ... He strolls about and about, to pass the time until the dinner hour. It somehow happens that Cloisterham seems reproachful to him today, has fault to find with him, as if he had not used it well, but is far more pensive with him than angry. His wonted carelessness is replaced by a wistful looking at, and dwelling upon, all the old Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.